You're a little loud today.
I'm a little out of control.
I'm sure this is a way to find it. Oh, we're on.
Really cool.
Just got it.
Okay, we'll go ahead and call the House Finance Committee to order. The time is 1:40. With us today is Representative Holm, Representative Foster, Co-Chair Representative Schnell, Vice Chairman Representative Stoltz, Representative Hawker, Representative Weimer, Representative Jewell, Representative Croft, and Representative Kelly is excused. On today's schedule, we have... before we get into today's schedule, I'm going to turn the gavel over to the co-chair of the operating budget, Representative Schnell.
Thank you, Co-Chair Myers. HB 66 and HB 67, which are on the agenda today, will be taken off the schedule for today. We're waiting on some updates, and the last budgets are closing out now, so we just also received the governor's amendments Friday. So we will bring those back at a later date, time specific, and we'll give you and the public plenty of notice so that you can participate in the process. So with that, Representative Meyer, turn the gavel back over to you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Schnell. With that in mind, were you hoping to do the supplemental, or did you?
We will probably work on the supplemental depending on how we finish with what you have on the schedule today.
Okay, very good. On today's schedule, we have three bills: House Bill 35, which is to extend the Board of Architects, Engineers, Surveyors by Representative Coring and staff, and House Bill 97, which has to do with oaths, notaries, public state seal, and House Bill 99. Which has to do with crimes involving controlled substances by the governor's office. So we'll take up House Bill 35 first. And presenting that will be Representative Coring, who is with us via teleconference. And let's see, Charisse Millett is here for questions, also with the Representative Coring's office.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Coring.
Hey, this is the representative.
Okay.
I'm online in Wasilla at the LAO here. I'm in Wasilla for a town meeting. I'll be back tonight. So if possible, I'd be happy to offer any comments on the bill and present it.
Okay, Representative Coring, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you so very much, both to you and Representative Chenault, for scheduling this bill, and I appreciate the members of the committee for hearing this legislation, and thank you for your indulgence as far as hearing me from a different location here. I know this isn't the first time, so I do appreciate your patience. House Bill 35 is a pretty simple, straightforward bill, as you've probably seen in the file there. It's just a one-paragraph bill that just simply extends the border registration, the termination date for the border registration for what's called the Architects, Engineers, Land Surveyors Board. It extends it for an additional 5 years, and it is scheduled to sunset on June 30th of this year. If the legislature were not to take action on this, they would enter into a one-year phase-out of the board and would be given 1 year following June 30th to terminate the board. I was approached and asked to present this bill to try to extend the termination date by the board. I have many people who I know who serve in these various professions, who I have a lot of respect for, who feel that this is an appropriate extension. And so that's what has caused me to advance this bill and motivates me to want to get this thing through. If I didn't identify myself earlier, this is Vic Coring, State Representative from House District 14, just for the record. And I won't read the sponsor statement verbatim here, but perhaps I'll just paraphrase or hit some of the highlights. There are 11 members that serve on the board appointed by the governor. We got two civil engineers, two land surveyors, one mining engineer, an electrical or mechanical engineer, and one engineer from another branch of the profession of engineering, two architects, one landscape architect, and one public member. And basically, the purpose of this board is to adopt regulations, oversee exams that are administered by the organization, suspend, revoke if necessary, or refuse issuance of new licenses. So that's essentially what they do. Now, there was an audit that was done that was required by state statute that was conducted back in November of last year. And the through the adept work of Pat Davidson, who I believe is present there to help answer questions, they concluded that the organization is serving its purpose very usefully, very effectively, and that they have conducted their business. Can you still hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Barely. Barely. You're fading, though, Mick.
I thought we were cut off. I apologize. But they, it was concluded by the ledge audit that they have conducted their business in a satisfactory manner, and that they recommend also that the board be continued. There are a couple of amendments here that are pretty simplistic in nature that are being recommended by the organization as well, including adding an additional member to the 10-member board called a landscape architect to the list. But I'll have, if it's all right, Pat Davidson or Mr. Keto or Ms. Dougherty, who are there, to explain those. So with that, I would just respectfully request your consideration of this legislation, and thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Representative Corrigan. Any questions for this one? Seeing none, thank you for joining us today, Representative Corrigan.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You betcha. Also, we have in the audience for questions, Pat Davidson with the Ledge Audit, and Rick Uron is also here for any questions we might have. To testify, though, we have Sam Keto III. Sam, do you want to come on up, please? Can you, for the record, state your name and who you're affiliated with, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sam Keto III. I am the chair of the Legislative Liaison Committee for the Alaska Professional Design Council. I'm also a registered civil engineer in Alaska. We'd like to thank Representative Corrigan for introducing this legislation, and we do fully support this legislation and the extension of the sunset for the AELS Board. The AELS Board performs a valuable function for the design professionals in Alaska, making sure that the licensed professionals meet certain critical standards for public safety. I'd be available for questions. I don't have anything more to add.
Okay. Thank you. Does that conclude your testimony?
Yes.
Representative Stoltz, then Representative Weber.
Thank you, Chairman Meyer. Mr. Keto, I vaguely remember in the late 90s there was legislation that to add the landscape architects, and there was some concern about, you know, having a member on the board, but they said it was if accreditation wasn't provided, they would continue to miss out, particularly on federal bid work. Have you guys done any analysis of what benefits have accrued from adding these folks onto the board, and has there been a substantial difference?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, the basic benefit so far has been limited, as we've only got approximately 30 licensed landscape architects in the state, but they are performing duties that are independent of what an architect can do and what a civil engineer can do. With respect to the board position, adding a landscape architect to the board actually would help the board. We will go from 10 voting members to 11 voting members, so we avoid the concerns of running into tie votes for various issues.
That hasn't necessarily helped, but it hasn't hurt.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, we don't have any information that really identifies what projects have been that we've been able to get from the landscape architect licensure, but we can find that information out and bring it back.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Representative Barber.
Mr. Chairman, these questions, Mr. Keto, have to do with the auditor's report, as long as you're coming up before the auditor. Actually, maybe if I can wait, Mr. Chairman, can we hear from the auditor, and then if I have questions
sure.
for Mr. Keto, then can you come back?
Yes.
Sure. Mr. Keto, you have some time constraints, correct? Okay.
I didn't mean to be presumptuous in that. No, it's hard to order your witnesses, but maybe answer it.
No, he was the only one signed up to testify, so Davis is available for questions. We do have one more online to testify, but we'll take him after Ms. Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit.
Ms. Navarro, did you have a question?
I can present the audit.
Okay.
We conducted an audit on the Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors. Based on the results of our audit, we did recommend that the termination date of June 30, 2005 be extended until June 30, 2009. During the last sunset review, we recommended that the legislature modify statutes to allow the board to implement continuing professional education requirements. While the legislature made statutory changes, the board has not yet implemented a CPE requirement. We recommend that either the board implement a continuing professional education requirement or the legislature consider modifying the statutes from a permissive program to a mandatory one. Additionally, we made a recommendation to the board that involves the continuing evolution of engineering profession. Alaska recognizes through licensure the core disciplines of civil, chemical, electrical, mechanical engineering, as well as mining and petroleum engineers. Other states have recognized other specialties or subspecialties. In this report, we recommend that the board, in conjunction either with the professional society or the university, conduct a study that would analyze the public benefits and the related costs associated with recognizing additional engineering specialties in Alaska's licensing structure. And third, we made a recommendation that the legislature should consider making the landscape architects a full voting member of the board.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Is your finding that the trend is to require civil and continuing education for engineers and others covered by your audit, but how important is that really? Because a lot of times you get professions to say, well, every time I do a work or a project, I'm always having to educate myself as to the specifics of the project, and also very seldom do standards standards change, so that sort of continuing education process isn't really necessary because we get educated, we have to take a professional engineer's exam or whatever. So, and because it's sort of, once you reach your level of professionalism, it's sort of rote from that point on. Why should the legislature impose an education requirement on this profession?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, what we're looking at in general, and this is sort of an approach that we take with all professions, is we look at why should the state, through public health, safety, welfare, get involved with licensing of professionals. What we see is that whether it's somebody just out of school or whether it's been somebody practicing for 15 years or somebody practicing for 30 years that only works occasionally, that the same level of public protection is necessary. While it's not perfect, I would say that when you look across the regulatory boards, what you're looking at is continuing professional education as one of the main mechanisms used for maintaining professional standards and maintaining that public welfare, public interest, public safety element associated with licensing.
Anything else?
Yeah, I have another question. Can I wait?
Can we come back to you? Okay. Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Davidson, what I'd like to go to here is your audit's thought process when it comes to a landscape architect. In your audit process, did you ever get any comments from industry with regards to the need of a landscape architect in the field?
Through the chairman, Representative Holmes, we did not do extensive work with regard to the landscape architect. What we had been doing is watching the evolution of them participating with the board and functioning as full board members. What we've seen is there's been a progression. They've been on there. They've been non-voting. And when you look at the people being represented on the board, what you see are mining engineers and landscape architects have about the same number of licensees. By statute, there has to be a mining engineer on the board, and sort of in recognition of that, what we were looking at, again, because they've been on the board and participating, maybe it's time for the legislature to look and get either keep them on the board and giving them the full voting authority on the board.
Well, I appreciate that through the chair. My concern is this. You don't know this about me, but I'll explain a little thing. I'm a horticulturalist, and I've been doing this in the state of Alaska for the past 50 years. In the state of Alaska, we do not have an Alaskan Association of Nurserymen, and in such, or because of that, we don't have what's called a platform, if you will, from which to build the horticultural knowledge that a landscape architect can use. And because of that, those who come from other areas of the world bring their information and it doesn't translate. And by that I mean as we have a number of cold hardiness zones in the state of Alaska. The items that are hardy in Ketchikan are not hardy in Fairbanks. They may not be hardy in Dutch Harbor and may not be hardy over in Kotzebue. And so landscape architects are a very peculiar breed. It is not like building a building given a certain amount of particulars. You know, the electrical, as I understand it, all the electrical and the compaction tests, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are all in books, and you can all set them in books. But there is no book in Alaska that tells a landscape architect what types of trees to put in a particular area. And because of that, and because they come here without the knowledge, it is a very difficult situation to just certify them in the state of Alaska and give them free rein to go ahead and do what they will. And let me explain to you why that's a problem. The reason that's a major problem is because they specify products that will not live here. The contractors cannot put them in because they'll die, or they put the money into them and double the prices because they have to follow the rules of the game. Because of that peculiarity, I would suggest without any type of complaints about the qualifications of any particular person who's in the industry here, that they really don't have a place at the board until there is some kind of a horticultural setup where we can say this person can justifiably work within the southern region or the southwestern or southeastern or northern or mid-Alaskan because it's completely different in all these different areas as to how you work. And those that come from Michigan to Fairbanks to work don't have a clue. Now, if you look at all the horticulturists, I'm sorry to take the time, Mr. Chairman, but it's an issue that I know a lot about, and it impacts adversely the cost of doing business in the state of Alaska in our industry.
And Richard Holm, that's fine, what you're saying and discussing there. But one thing I failed to mention is that we do have one person online who is with the American Society of Landscape Architects, so they might be able to answer some questions.
Perfectly fine. I just wanted to lay that out for you because it is kind of a problem for me personally, and I think you know if you're somebody online, it'd be fine. They could certainly address that. So. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll wait to additionally speak.
Thank you. Representative Paul? Representative
Croft. I guess I'm trying to continue on Representative Wyrock's line of questioning. So is it your position, Pat, that you want to move all professions to having some sort of continuing education? Is that sort of a generic? I see it often in the audits, and enough so it seems like a pattern to me. Do you feel that all professions ought to have some form of continuing education?
Through the chairman, Representative Croft, I don't think I'd make quite that blanket a statement. One of the things that we look at, though, is how is the public served by maintaining the quality of professions that they just don't get past that initial, but they maintain their professional requirements. Some are going to be required to have evaluations, peer reviews, various things through professional societies, so you can't make a blatant statement with regard to continuing professional education. What I meant to say is that continuing professional education is a common way to lead professionals into continued competency. You cannot say that continuing professional education means continued competency. You can't make that leap because that's going to be an individual thing. But as you look across many professions, what you do is you see in an effort to maintain continued professional competency, one of the mechanisms that's commonly used is professional education.
I guess on a philosophical matter, whether we should decide that for the professions, whether you should through an audit or we should through legislation, or whether in general we ought to defer to the boards for them to balance whether they're sufficient through professional organizations or whatever, or whether it's needed. There's a question of whether it should be mandated, and then the question of who should make that decision itself. And I guess I'm not yet convinced that it should be us, and would tend to think it should be the boards generally, unless we see some conflict of interest or something that prevents it. I defer to the individual professional boards on whether they think they need it or not. It wasn't much of a question at the end, but I do think in general that the boards should be able to decide that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Croft, any comments there? Okay.
It's up to the legislature.
Okay, Representative Barber.
I do think that it's important, and I'm not going to propose it here, and this, I don't have any further questions of this witness. It's probably for Mr. Keto.
Okay. Very good. Let's take a Representative Stoltz has a question here.
I'll save her.
You're going to save yours. Okay. All right, let's go back to Mr. Keto, and then I do want to catch Terry, who's online. Mr. Keto. I think Representative Weirich has a question.
Mr. Keto, in these kind of situations where the legislature is endorsing the continuation of a board that oversees a professional organization, a professional occupation, the only real concern that I have is that as a member of the public that often hires architects and engineers with superior education, I do so based on their professional training and expertise, and a lot of times what I do is I accept their recommendations because I don't know any better. And it gives me some comfort to know that there is some code of ethics that has been adopted that can be imposed by an oversight board for that profession that details how they disclose their fees to the public, whether they disclose whether they have a conflict of interest if such a thing is necessary, whether the board is going to analyze these things impartially and impose sanctions if necessary, and so that the public doesn't have to finance that sort of thing through legislation. A lot of times we defer these things to boards to make sure that sort of practice happens to give the public some comfort that there's some oversight function that occurs. Now, whether that's part of the continuing education process to update individuals, I know that Spiro Agnew was a member of the Board of Engineers, and his work was found out by an ethics group of engineers. And one of the, Joe Alter, locally, was one of the people that found that sort of unethical conduct that eventually led to his downfall. So it is important. I think it does have broad ramifications for the public's confidence in what is provided to their services. So I just wonder if you could just give an update on what the profession is doing to regulate its own.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Weirich. Basically what happened last year is there was a piece of legislation that actually authorized the AELS board to adopt regulations regarding continuing education. And this came more at the urging of the surveyors within the group. The surveyors have been the most ready to adopt continuing education standards. My understanding is the architects are very closely behind, and in recent years the civil engineers, who had not been typically in favor of continuing education, have recognized the importance of continuing education on a national scale. So the American Society of Civil Engineers nationally has adopted some continuing education standards that for most civil engineers is at least available if there are continuing education requirements imposed by a local licensing board. So there are other professions that I'm not so sure are quite ready. The National Society of Professional Engineers, as far as a oversight organization, would have the responsibility for the other disciplines, mechanical, mining, electrical, engineering, that may or may not have national organizations that have continuing education requirements. But as far as the AELS board, surveyors have national standards that they're working on trying to put into regulation that would be overseen by the AELS board. The architects are pretty close, and the civil engineers are pretty close as well. I hope that answers your question.
Answer your question, Christian Barber.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Keto. I see no other questions for you. Thank you very much. We'll go online now to Terry Schoenthal with the American Society of Landscape Architects. Terry,
Mr.
you still?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Excuse me for interrupting there. Do we have an amendment before us, or are we just listening to the architect's argument?
We don't have an amendment in front of us right now. We're just taking discussion.
Thank you. Terry, are you online?
I am. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Terry Schoenthal. I'm here today representing the American Society of Landscape Architects, the Alaska chapter. And I personally actually own a landscape architecture and planning firm here in Anchorage that does work all over the state. Earlier heard input of Mr. Holmes about the nurserymen here in the state, and he has some very valid points. We work obviously in a state that ranges from all the way in southeast to the far north, and a lot of different conditions. We rely pretty heavily on the state's nurserymen as well as our university system to provide us information on that. But I would like to assert perhaps a different opinion on it, that the state AELS board is fundamentally there for the purposes of protection of health, safety, and welfare of our state citizenry. We cannot, and in fact in our licensing, we don't actually have a plant category of the testing related to Alaskan plants. But we do often come in contact with, and the reason that we've become licensed in the state of Alaska is because we deal with a number of health, safety, and welfare concerns. Some of them include, for example, the design of playgrounds at our schools around the state. There are a number of very specific issues associated with that sort of design. Additionally, we're often consulted with regard to drainage and stormwater management. Quite frequently now, the use of biofiltration is one of the means of dealing with stormwater management, and it's an area that landscape architects have developed a considerable expertise in. Some of the other areas include highway design. Frequently around the state, landscape architects are very closely involved both in the layout of highways as well as the landscaping associated with that. And particularly with highways and with commercial development, the understanding of the impact of plant materials on site distances and a variety of other things are some of the issues that become important in terms of health, safety, and welfare. And these types of issues actually do translate to a number of states. We, as has been pointed out, we constitute about 30 licensed professionals in the state, and we've come to that number now over a period of about 4 years. I would guess that it's highly likely that our numbers could double within the next decade, just because we're relatively new licensed field. Like the other professionals on the AELS board, one of the things that having our representation there does is it brings back to the board the kind of national trends and changes that influence how the board changes its requirements. An example already under discussion today is the issue of continuing education. Individual professions around the United States, the surveyors in particular, it's been noted, and the architects, really have brought back those requirements for continuing education to the AELS board. And I would envision our role on that board to be very similar. I can be open to answering any questions you have at this time.
Okay, Terry, I appreciate that testimony. We'll see if Representative Holm has a follow-up to some of his questions and discussion he had earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Schoenthal, is that correct?
That's Schoenthal? Correct, yes.
That is correct.
Thank you for testifying today. You know, I'm not against landscape architects. I don't want you to get that type of a feeling about it. It's just that in my experience over the past, particularly in the past 10 years, it's been very apparent to me, being in the business, how ill-informed your industry has been. And certainly they've come to me for a great number of ascertainments of what grows in our area and what does not grow and what's available and what's not available. But it's very, very apparent that coming out of schools like Oregon or places like that, that majority of the information that they get and that they utilize it doesn't translate very well. And I guess what my concern is, as much as anything, is that there is some particular standard that could be put into place for competency. And I frankly question, in a horticultural sense, I question your abilities to come up with the numbers at this point in time. Certainly in the interior of Alaska, it may not be true in the south central, it may not be true in the southeastern or the southwestern, I do not know. I just know in my particular area that there's very little concern for utilizing past information and doing the translation as I see it into the future projects. So I guess that's my comment to you. And I'll give you an example. There's no consistency as the number of the depth of topsoil, for example, for lawns. It's totally inconsistent in your industry, and depending upon the friability of the soil makes a whole lot of difference as to how it works. And so, obviously, if you don't have the horticultural knowledge at hand, coming from a school in Oregon or Washington or any other place in the country and coming to the interior of Alaska, it's very hard for you to put specifications in place that really make a whole lot of sense. So I'd appreciate your comments to that.
Okay, thank you, Representative Holm. Mr. Schoenthal, any comments?
Just briefly on it. I would tend to agree with Mr. Holmes in at least in part on that, in that we do have an issue with varying conditions around the state, particularly up in the Fairbanks area or in interior, where not only, for example, Mr. Holmes has brought up the issue of soils, friability. In many places around the state, the simple availability of topsoil can be a huge issue. And from my perspective as a landscape architect, I really try to verify the availability of topsoil, what's going to work in a given area. But that is from my own perspective in terms of practice. I guess I would just like to step back once on this and reiterate that in fact our role on the board is more related to the health, welfare, and kind of risk factors associated with our profession in the state than specifically towards plant materials or soils or other materials used in the landscape in landscape design.
Okay.
Mr.
Chairman. Thank you. Anything else there, Representative Holm, before we go to some of
No, I don't think so, but I just would like to make the point that a competency to me is as great a reason for you to have a professional organization as is any other reason. So I think my statements have led my thoughts to that point. So.
Very good.
Enough said.
Certainly learned a lot about landscaping today. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hold on a point. Just get over to him if you need to.
Representative Barber, did you have a...
Well, I just haven't had a discussion of friability since soils in college, so I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to follow up. I'm just trying to reach back in my memory and doing some research. When this was originally sold, adding the landscape architect, it's we're not going to have a regulatory function. We just want to get on here so we'll be able to bid on some federal jobs that require this certification, and we don't have this regulatory yearning to get involved in the micromanagement. And it was certainly presented in a lot more benign fashion. I appreciate groups wanting to be represented on the board, but Representative Croft was in the legislature at that time. I don't know if he remembers the debate on this, but it was presented in a real narrow fashion. We really just need this to bid on some federal jobs, and then if we have this quasi representation on the board, and now it's with any board you get on there, and there's this creep of wanting more responsibility and more regulatory ability. I'm usually on the same page as Representative Corning on encroachment of government. And I just want to make sure I'm heading the right direction.
Thank you.
Something that's always presented to me, and it's anecdotal, is maybe I don't know where the education is derived from all these folks, but a complaint I hear constantly from my local growers is that there's not any kind of serious commitment to using local vegetation, seeds, and we get into the same kind of putting mountain ash in the middle of meridians in Eagle River, and just the kind of just things that just don't make any sense. And I'm not I don't know if that's with all due respect to landscape architects, and I'm not. I trust the judgment. I go down and talk to Paul Dinkins and his folks at PNM Gardens in Eagle River, or I seem to get a lot more common sense type approach on how to deal with stuff in my yard than if the system evolves. So I've got to hire a landscape architect eventually. I don't know what the city municipality of Anchorage will eventually evolve to, and I'm afraid if regulations are in place, I don't want to be a part of this slippery slope. So is that a question or an editorial? I forget.
I'm not sure if there's a question in it or not, but we'll continue on. Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Okay, that is all we had lined up to testify on this. There is a couple of amendments that we received too late to get incorporated in the packet, so the plan is to hold this bill over, take up the amendments tomorrow, and then hopefully pass out the bill tomorrow. Is there any other questions or comments for the folks that are here at this time? Now we'll go ahead and close the public hearing and then take up the amendments tomorrow. So thank you very much, Patrice. Representative Corning, if you're still there, thank you, and we'll deal with this tomorrow.
I am still here, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for the questions. They're all well noted, and look forward to bringing up the bill again.
All right. Thanks for staying with us.
You're welcome. Have a good afternoon.
You're welcome to continue to stay with us if you'd like, Representative.
Well, I'd sure love to. I've got a long list of things to do, but thanks for the offer.
All right, thank you. Yep.
Good afternoon. See you back in Juneau.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, next bill is the House Bill 97, Oath, Notaries, Public, Notary Public, and let's see. With us is Scott Clark, who's the notary administrator, and Brian Wested, who's an intern with the Office of the Lieutenant Governor. So, let's see, testimony, don't have anyone lined up to testify, is that correct? Okay. So, with that, Scott, why don't you go ahead and give us your name, affiliation, and explain the bill to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Clark is my name. I'm Lieutenant Governor Lehman's notary administrator, and I'm going to let Brian give you the summary. In your packets, you should have received a frequently asked questions document and a table of changes between the current statute and the old statute.
For the record, my name is Brian Wested. I'm an intern with Lieutenant Governor Lehman's office. The bill before you is House Bill 97, which addresses the changes in Alaska's notary statutes, which have not been updated since 1961. These changes being proposed today have been suggested by Alaska notaries working together with Lieutenant Governor Lehman's office. These proposed changes are outlined in the notary statute comparison sheet, which you all have in front of you. and I shall walk you through that. They're arranged in the categories of qualifications, terms, fees, bond, commission types, commission revocations, and notary data. So, moving to the sheet. Currently, we have qualifications where applicants must be a resident of the state and at least 19 years of age. Major change we're making is we are lowering that minimum requirement to 18 years of age. This has been asked of us by banks here in Alaska because that enables their tellers who are hired frequently at the age of 18 to become notaries, thus increasing their efficiency and performance. Again, they must be a resident of the state. Currently, the term is 4 years, and they will continue to stay at the term of 4 years. We also have automatic revocation of commissions of state employee notaries who terminate employment prior to the commission expiration date. To my understanding of this, and Scott can correct me if I'm incorrect, but this will also create another type of notary, a state notary, which performs official state work, and their commission expires when their position here with the state is over with. Is that correct? Thank you, sir. Currently, the fees, there's a $40 application fee that will remain the same. Currently, we have a $2 price tag for Lieutenant Governor's certificate, which Scott here has to show you. We are changing that to $5. To, again, this change hasn't happened in over 40 years, and to keep with the current prices of materials, we need to increase the price. And again, Scott has a copy of this certification form if you'd like to see it. Moving on to commission types. Again, Notary Public will continue to serve a four-year commission, and the state employee will serve until their time with the state job is over with. Commission revocation. I'm going to allow Scott to enlighten you more about that. Okay, never mind. Via Administrative Procedure Act, I'm just reading here, Act must be invoked to review all complaints against notaries, no matter how trivial, proposed as by Lieutenant Governor for good cause via a formal disciplinary procedure using administrative hearing office. Notary data, currently we are collecting notaries' names, mailing address, certi information, and commission dates, which are available to the public. We're proposing to create a database which will have more information, not given to anyone who could potentially spam them, but more for our own records. In case we do need to get a hold of them, we will have their phone number and email, which would be much needed. Finally, we have non-commissioned notaries, which are the list before you, and there will be no changes in that area. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? For Scott or Brian. Representative Croft.
Yeah, I guess on the I'm confused about the way the procedure for revocation changes. Before it was purely under the Administrative Procedure Act, and now it seems to be a shared responsibility between the Lieutenant Governor and maybe the Administrative Procedure. Can you flesh that out a little bit?
I can, through the chair, Representative Croft, I can certainly try. In the bill, section 68 and 69, I believe, we're looking at. 68 gives the Lieutenant Governor the authority to revoke or suspend the commission based on the grounds of those subsections, which are fairly technical. They would be grounds.
What page are you on?
On 16. On grounds for which the application for commission could be denied. So if the status of the notary changes so that they no longer qualify for a commission, that would be grounds for the Lieutenant Governor to revoke the commission. For example, the extreme case would be if they were convicted of a felony during the course of their commission, then that would give the Lieutenant Governor the ability to revoke the commission. Failure to comply with this chapter, which has technical requirements for the acts that they're performing as notaries. So if they violate the law in any act that they perform, that would give the Lieutenant Governor the ability to revoke or suspend commission. The third aspect there is a little more nebulous. incompetence or malfeasance in carrying out the notary public's duties under this chapter. So all of these are fairly technical and relate to the legislation itself, the bill. The next section deals with the situation where the public might call and complain about a notary and say, and we would have to investigate. And in that situation, instead of the lieutenant governor having the authority to revoke the commission, it would go through the Office of Administrative Hearings that was created last year for an impartial decision in that situation. And I would imagine that those situations would be a little more less clearly defined and would require some degree of investigation, and at that point having an impartial third party make the decision probably makes sense.
Paul?
Well, the in the procedure in 069 on page 16 and 17, there are a number of points where the lieutenant governor can find that there's not adequate cause to proceed, and that makes some sense. But in the final analysis, if there's going to be a determination made of a violation of the chapter, incompetence, malfeasance, whatever, it's going to be made according to the administrative hearings. And so 068 kind of surprised me in that it repeats 069 but gives the lieutenant governor the sole power to do it. It doesn't seem require a hearing, which, I mean, 69 goes through this process of did I find probable cause, if you will, did I find the cause to go forward, and then if you finally do, there's some sort of hearing that they get to determine whether it happened, whether or not. I don't see the procedures in 68 for a hearing. The lieutenant governor could just decide for good cause that there'd been incompetence and revoke somebody's notary.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, actually you're correct. I don't believe it's our intent to rob the notaries of a chance to appeal any decision under the law. It may be appropriate to add a subsection to 68 that, similar to subsection G on page 17 on line 14, that would also specifically state that the notary would have the ability to appeal any decision that the lieutenant governor made. That would not be a bad idea, I would say.
I guess I expected to see these two provisions collapsed into one. I understand there may be a procedural distinction between I got a complaint and I have to deal with it versus I, myself, the lieutenant governor, have some reason to believe that there's some reason to bring forward this, but that the two would at some point sort of merge together, and whether the lieutenant governor had brought it up, him or herself, or had been by a complaint, that fairly quickly you would end up with the same procedures and the same appeal rights and the same, and instead it looks like it's two very different tracks depending on whether it's a complaint filed or not. I guess I'm searching for the purpose for that.
Through the chair, I can't necessarily disagree with anything you said. If you're inclined to maybe amend the bill in that direction, I would just make a few points that the thing that precipitated this change is that the current situation is so cumbersome that it's ineffective. It's never been invoked, to my knowledge, because it's just such a cumbersome process. So I would respectfully suggest that if we make any amendments to this, that we approach it from the direction of giving the lieutenant governor the authority to suspend and revoke, and then using the administrative hearings officer as an appeal mechanism so that there's fairness.
I see. In the decision. It almost sounds like, and apologize, but
no,
this may lead to just a simple amendment that everyone agrees on. It's almost a matter of suspending. The lieutenant governor ought to have some power to very quickly suspend and then have a process, you know, have a hearing to determine whether that was appropriate, but sort of in the public interest to stop somebody from using their notary for a short period of time until the hearing happens. Is it?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, I think we're on the same page. I can't disagree with anything that you said.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Croft. Are you formulating a conceptual amendment? Perhaps?
Yeah, I apologize. It's one of those things that just comes up. Yeah. I've been staring at those two provisions. I wanted to ask.
That's fine. Representative Hawker.
I had a question too.
Yeah, just thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I had the exact same line of questioning and concerns as Representative Croft. I think he's identified the issue very well, and I also would like to see this amendment brought forward before we move the bill, sir.
Okay, very good. Lieutenant Weber.
I think that, Mr. Chairman, should probably, if there's going to be an appeal, it shouldn't be in the duplicate language in multiple sections. It could be a simple section that applies to other provisions where the Lieutenant Governor has to make a decision, so it could be a separate section altogether instead of just putting it the same when it, over and over. You might want to look at that as long as you're looking at it. See which one's more elegant. Through the Department of Law, maybe Debbie Bear has it.
Through the Chair, Representative Warwick, is that a direction for us to draft?
Well, you just consider it rather than plopping it in a bunch of different places, maybe just more elegant. We did have another question, Phil. On the qualification to be commissioned as a notary, you, under Section 8 of the bill on page 8, it indicates that you, in order to be a commissioned, you may not have been incarcerated in a correctional facility for a felony within 10 years before the commission takes effect. Does that mean you can be convicted of a felony but not incarcerated, but you can still qualify then?
Through the Chair, is it possible to be convicted of a felony and not be incarcerated?
It's possible, I suppose.
I would guess that at that point, since there wouldn't be any incarceration, that 10-year period would go into effect and after 10 years. But I see what you're saying, since it's
specifically... You're not incarcerated. I mean, the concern about notary is you want somebody who's trustworthy. If there's a crime of lack of trustworthiness or theft or something like that, which would be a felony, and you're put on probation, that's why incarcerated or not is the question.
I don't think it's, through the Chair, Representative Wyrock, I don't think it's occurred to anybody the possibility that somebody could be convicted of a felony and not be incarcerated. So if we can come up with wording that would adjust that so that it would take both situations into consideration.
Well, all I suggest is if, when you're coming back on the other amendment, if you just come back and address that. Another question, Mr. Chairman, is as long if you've had a notary public commission revoked in this state or another jurisdiction, you're apparently never able to be commissioned as a notary, but if you've been convicted of a felony and it was 10 years ago, you could. So if there's something ministerial, but your commission is revoked, you can never be a notary again, but if you're convicted of a felony, you can be a notary again. And I just, that seemed, why would you want to prohibit completely somebody who's had their notary revoked but not somebody who's committed a felony? What's public policy in that?
Mr. Chairman, through the Chair, Representative Wyrock, another good point. I don't necessarily disagree with what you just stated.
Well, if you could come back again and address that.
Okay. I think we've brought up some good points here. I actually had a question to you. For the record, Representative Moses has joined us. Welcome. It looks like we're changing fees, but the application fee is still staying at $40. Is that fee also been the same since 61? Or?
Mr. Chairman, no. The application fee was raised, I believe, from $20 to $40 in 1990, in May of 1990. So it's been almost 15 years at $40, and we don't propose to make any changes to the fee at this time.
Been a lot of inflation since 1990, but Representative Weber.
I was going to ask about the fee, Mr. Chairman. I just didn't know why we stayed the same, other than just it's some one of those arbitrary things. We just stay the same on some and not the others.
Through the Chair, Representative Weber, as Brian mentioned in his initial summary, we did go out to notaries and industries that employ a lot of notaries, and they bear the burden of the expense, and they weren't interested in a fee increase. And we didn't feel that there was any merit to increasing the fee. $40 seems to be reasonable. We've compared that fee to what other states do, and it's definitely already at the top of that ballpark.
Mr. Chairman,
follow up.
What was the fee to get a bond in 1990 compared to now? Because I have to buy a notary bond every time my notary expires. Renew your bond.
Representative Wyrock, I'm not sure what notary bonds cost at that time. I would guess that they haven't increased
Alaska notary bonds are a great deal for the bonding companies because the amount of the bond is so small that nobody ever makes any claims against them. So I don't imagine that they raise the fee on what they charge for the bond sales for quite a while. But I don't know. I could research that and get back to you if you'd like.
I just had one other question.
Okay, go ahead.
I think I'm finished, Mr. Chairman. The test that notaries take, is a test required?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, the test is no longer required. Our materials indicate that the test is mandatory, but in researching the statutes and working on this project, we couldn't find any authority that the Lieutenant Governor had to require a test and make it mandatory. So it's no longer mandatory. We still strongly suggest that people take the test, and as a result of the changes that this bill will bring about, we're intending to expand the testing program, maybe make it self-guided through our website and offer a lot more in that area. Mm-hmm. But
If the test isn't required anymore, is it required that the notary keep a log of their signatures and the dates? And
through the chair, Representative Wyrock, it's not required by law, but notaries are strongly urged to keep a notary journal, and it really is an essential element of the act of notarization. So it's not technically, it's not mentioned in the statutes, it's not mentioned in this bill. It's another contentious notarial subject. There's a lot of objection to the idea of a mandatory journal, but there are very good reasons to keep the journals. The notaries are personally liable for every act that they perform as a notary, and the only way they can prove that they complied with the law for each act they perform is to keep a journal. And it also serves the public's best interest by serving as a record to these transactions if they're questioned. So we have always suggested that the notaries keep journals, and we'll continue to approach it from that direction.
Thank you, Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up Representative Wyrock's line of questioning, but specifically to the $40 fee, are we receiving sufficient revenue for this $40 fee to pay for the cost of administering this program?
Representative, through the chair, Representative Hawker, I believe so. We have about 3,000 notary commissions that we do each year. That pulls in about $120,000, and I believe that covers the cost of the program.
Thank you.
Just follow up on that, and then I'll go direction home. I think since we are in the process of raising the fees, and you probably don't want to come before us, and we probably don't want to see you for a couple more years, I would, no offense, I would suggest that we maybe bump that $40 also, maybe to $45 or $50, so that way you're not coming back in a couple of years and saying we need to raise this. Because if you haven't raised it since 1990, I think it's certainly justifiable.
Representative Meyer, Mr. Chairman, all due respect, I appreciate what you're suggesting there, but we would really like to see this bill pass, and I fear that if we try to raise that fee that we're going to have a lot of opposition to it all of a sudden, and may scuttle the entire thing eventually. So we've looked at the fees carefully and have no reason to believe that they're out of line with the rest of the country or the costs incurred by the program.
Didn't think about this one in Ways and Means. We could have got it for more.
That's right. Okay, Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I suspect we might be able to call that a tax. Is that what we're saying on the notary public? My question was, I think, answered, but you said there was roughly 3,000 notary public in the state. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Holm, we process about 3,000 notary commissions each year, so we currently have about 12,000 active notaries, and the commissions are for four-year periods. So
they rotate every fourth year.
We have 12,000 active notaries, and
12,000 total.
Do about 3,000 a year.
All right, thank you very much.
Representative Stoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may have already been answered when I stepped out for some important business in the hallway. What industries or professions of the 3,000, is there any preponderance of does any industry dominate this? Are there more gardeners or whatever?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, the gardening industry is a huge user of notaries, I'm sure. But the banking industry seems to be a very common place for people to go get things notarized. Historically, they're a big user of notaries. But all
businesses in the industry find it convenient to have notaries on staff. So the business world in general, I would say, is especially banking, though.
My bank, I've been at the same bank since I was in about second grade. They have a schedule sign there. If I'm a customer, they do it for free. Do they have it there as a convenience, or is it a revenue producer, or what's?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz. That's been my experience, that most banks will offer notarial services to their customers free of charge.
Anything else, Mr. Stoltz? President Crop.
Very briefly on the $40 issue, you know, I appreciate that we're the Finance Committee and that we recognize there's still a fiscal gap long-term out there and all these ideas, but, you know, the question is not have we raised it since 1990, it might have been way too high in 1990. The question sort of is what the witnesses brought up. Does it bring in an amount of money appropriate to run the services we provide for it? Seems to. And is it commensurate, kind of on the high side, kind of on the low side, between versus other states? And if we're on the high side with other states and we're providing enough money to run the program, even if it hasn't been changed since 1990, I'm not sure that we need to hear. You want to look at a fee that hasn't changed in 15 years and make sure that it does. But it seems like the questions they've answered assured me that it does meet those sort of more objective criteria.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Crofton. Certainly, I'm not going to suggest an increase if you think it covers your costs adequately. It's just that we're raising the fees for the certificate from 2 to 5, so it just made me believe that perhaps the application costs have gone up too. But if you're okay with that, then that's fine. Representative Bart.
However, I think it still behooves us to look at what the cost is and what. I mean, I think it's still worthwhile to look at it objectively, so we're just not operating in a philosophic or analytic void. So, anyway, I would just, Mr. Chairman, I would ask the witness if they could bring forward information on the cost, so at least we have that to analyze.
Okay. Can you do that, Mr. Clark?
Mr. Chairman, I can do that, certainly.
Okay, what I'd like to do... Ms. Suzanne Cunningham, my staff, has taken down everyone's concerns here, and she'll be working with you to come back with a CS. So perhaps with the CS and some of this documentation that the committee members have asked, then we'll bring this bill back forward at that time. Not sure how long that'll take, but probably a couple days anyway. Okay. Is there anything else to come before... On this particular bill, Representative Schnell.
Yeah, thanks. I would have one question. Is there some way to log actually how many times a notary uses their seal in a year?
Through the chair, Representative Schnell. Without a notary journal, there's no way to track that type of activity.
Well, I was just curious as to how they came up with the fiscal note that by raising the fees from $2 to $5 that you anticipated that it would be an 8.7.
Through the chair, Representative
Schnell. Restricted funds.
The fees that are referenced there, I was worried there might be a misunderstanding, are not related to the notaries or the public in general at all. They're a very special type of certificate that we produce. In essence, we're verifying that a notary is a notary, and these are attached to documents that are going to foreign countries. And foreign governments won't oftentimes accept notarized documents from any other country without this type of certificate attached. So it's a real specialized use. And we do between 2,000 and 3,000 of those a year, so that represents the $8,700 in the fiscal note.
And what do most social certificates deal with?
Well, what we're doing is, through the chair, Representative, we're verifying that notaries are really notaries. If you had a document you wanted to submit, a business document you were going to submit to Russia,
had your notarized signature on it, you would send it to our office. We would check the signature on the notary signature on your document against the sample that we have on file, and then prepare a certificate for the Russian government verifying that that notary was really a notary and that their signature appeared to be genuine. The samples that we're passing around are what we generate.
Thanks. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Schnell. Okay, no other questions or comments, and we'll set this bill aside and take it up as soon as we get a new CS prepared. Bring it back for me. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that brings us to the next bill we were hoping to hear. I see we have some education folks here. Is your intent to take up this supplemental yet today?
Depends on where we end up here.
On this bill.
What do you think your time frame is for?
We'll see. We'll see where it goes. Let's go ahead and continue on then with House Bill 99. And this is crimes involving controlled substances. We have Ann Carpinetti is going to be doing the presenting of the bill. She's with the Department of Law. Signed up for testimony. Looks like we have Sergeant Tim Burt. With Alaska State Troopers, James Steele in Wasilla, he's available for questions. I don't know if Dr. Richard Mansinger is with us. No, okay. And Detective Ed Bryant. Oh, okay. All right, and then we may have others who want to testify in the audience or who are online. I don't have on my list. So, Ms. Carpinetti, good to see you. Welcome to House Finance.
Thank you. My name is Ann Carpinetti. I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I'll just be describing this bill briefly because there are witnesses who are much better able to discuss meth and the crimes and the dangers of meth as it has grown in our state. But I would like to just summarize what this bill does. And it does three things. First, it provides that it is manslaughter to manufacture or deliver meth in violation of our drug laws, ASL 1171, if a person dies as a direct result of ingesting the drug. The bill also specifically provides that there is no additional culpable mental state required for the state to prove its case in chief. That is, the culpable mental state for the drug offense itself is what the state needs to prove. This is specifically allowed in our law as long as the legislature makes it clear that that's what they intended to do. Illegal drug makers and deliverers give dangerous drugs to people. They do that in violation of the law, and they deliver drugs that there's no control over the dosage or the amount of dangerous material in them. They disregard the risk that people take when they ingest these drugs, and they disregard the fact that people die as a result of taking them. Making this conduct specifically homicide does not break new ground in the law. Several other states have similar provisions. They range from murder in the first degree, some have murder in the second degree, murder in the third degree, or felony murder, or manslaughter provisions too. And I have here examples of what other states do. I'll be happy to share them with you if you'd like. The second thing that the bill does is it creates a new form of child endangerment in the first degree, or the endangerment of the welfare of a child, by providing that it's a Class C felony to manufacture or attempt to manufacture methamphetamine in violation of our drug laws, AS 1171, in a building if you are reckless as to whether or not children under 18 use the building as a dwelling. Building in the bill is described in a little bit broader fashion as under current criminal law. Right now, our criminal law in Title 11 defines building as a unit in an apartment. This specifically provides that different apartments in a particular building are considered the same building because of the dangers of methamphetamine. And you'll hear testimony from people who will describe the danger of the chemicals that are used and how they can go from one apartment to another and endanger people living in the building. The third thing that the bill does is it changes the penalty for possessing methamphetamine in an organic solution. If there's an intent to extract from that organic solution powdered methamphetamine, Right now it's a Class C felony to possess meth, but it's a Class A felony to possess a precursor of methamphetamine with intent to manufacture methamphetamine, and it's also a Class A felony to manufacture methamphetamine. People who work in the in drug prosecution in our state, police officers and prosecutors, tell us that in certain areas of the state particularly, people possess methamphetamine in solution, in an organic solution. And the reason they do that is they have it like they would possess a precursor, and they extract from it powdered meth. And this is, in their opinion, as dangerous as possessing a precursor of methamphetamine with intent to manufacture meth and distribute it. But it's not chemically a precursor, so we've described it as methamphetamine in an organic solution, which is how they possess it. This bill would provide that this possession of the organic methamphetamine in an organic solution with the intent to extract from it powdered meth is also a Class A felony. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Okay, we do have Representative Schnell, then we go to Representative Weber.
When you were talking about children and buildings, I would assume that that would apply to a case that's probably ongoing in Fairbanks where they busted a meth lab in a motel or a hotel. Without knowing what the definition of buildings are, I assume that if you're going to take into consideration an apartment, that that also a motel, hotel would apply.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Representative
Weber. Thanks, and I appreciate the administration bringing this bill forward. Everything I read about methamphetamine, it's a national epidemic. It's a huge problem. But you had mentioned methamphetamine is the purpose of the bill, and that's not in the title at all. Not that it would matter, but is it? Is this really just directed, this bill just directed at methamphetamine?
Well, it's in a sense it is, because two of the sections deal directly with it. But it has a broader context. And in fact, for the manslaughter provision, it's any distribution or manufacture of a drug in violation of any of our drug laws that causes the death of a person. So it deals with meth specifically in a certain way, but it also deals with other provisions of our drug law.
Does the current criminal law allow seizure and sale of a building or a car if it's used in the manufacture, distribution of methamphetamine?
Through the chair, I believe so, but I would like to inform myself better before I answer you specifically that question.
Could you let me know?
I will. I will do that.
I was concerned that as long as we're dealing with methamphetamine, it's such a huge problem. We really have to hit it hard, I think, and I want to make sure that if that were not the case, that we allowed at least law enforcement or civil authorities the opportunity to do that. The other thing is it correct that methamphetamine cannot be made without Sudafed?
Through the chair, there are people online who can answer that question better than I can. I would defer to them.
Okay. The other thing is endangering a child or anyone else in a methamphetamine lab. It's my understanding, as you testified, that methamphetamine and the sort of the vapors it gives off can soak into and affect walls, carpet, sheetrock, on and on, upholstery, and that anyone who uses a building like that, apartment, can leave, and it leaves behind this residual that essentially has to be ripped out and is because it poses a hazard.
That's my understanding, and it's not just in that particular unit. It gets into the airwaves of the building, and it affects other parts of the building far away.
Is it the intent of this bill that criminal prosecution and the application of this bill, if it were enacted into law, would allow prosecution of any effect as long as it reaches into where that methamphetamine may travel? In other words, if it endangers any person or child in any part of the building or home, even if it's a secondary owner, the person who was responsible for having the methamphetamine in the first place could still be culpable criminally.
Through the chair, well, it provides that if you manufacture it in a building with reckless disregard to the danger of any child in that whole structure, you can be prosecuted for endangering the welfare of the child in the first degree. Mm-hmm.
But reckless disregard is a higher standard than... it's a very high standard, isn't it, reckless disregard?
Through the chair, it's generally we say that intentional is the highest that we to prove, and then knowingly is the second, and reckless disregard is next serious. So it's not one of, I always think of it as four culpable mental states, and it's the third out of four, the fourth being criminal negligence. So it's a higher standard than criminal negligence, but it's not as high as...
Criminal negligence would say no or should have known would have some sort of harder heart or something?
Through the chair, criminal negligence is generally not perceiving a very serious risk. Recklessness means perceiving the risk and disregarding it.
Do we want to cast the wet not wider to lower to that lower culpable mental state or not? And if we did, would that have a fiscal impact to the prisons that they're filling up with people that are subject to that, public defenders and prosecutions, and the fiscal note on this bill?
Through the chair, that's an interesting question. It seems to me that most meth labs or most production activities with regard to meth are going to be, we will be able to prove reckless because of the dangerousness of the subject, of the substance. And plus, our law provides that if, maybe I'm misunderstanding your question. Our law provides if we have to prove recklessness in our case in chief, we can also, knowing and intentionally, if we can prove that, that's included. It would just not include.
Okay, then I'll have one question. The purpose of my question on the Sudafed one, and maybe it saves you time, if Sudafed is a critical component of methamphetamine, wouldn't it be simpler to simply outlaw Sudafed sale or distribution in the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, I suppose it might be simpler, but I think there are legitimate uses for Sudafed in medication. But, you know, there are several bills in the legislature now that would, I think, regulate the sale of that type of chemical.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. We do have a bill. Representative Remmers has a bill dealing with that.
And Representative Crawford, too.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. There's several. Okay. Any other questions for Ms. Carpenter? I'm sorry.
The point that Representative Wyrick said, Mr. Chairman, we did pass a bill a couple of years ago, if you recall, that did mandatory cleanup on those areas that were sites, and so hopefully that protects the youngsters that go in. But it doesn't have anything to do with the contributory negligence, as you just pointed out, that while they're doing the process, they can still affect those in the building. So. This is a good bill. But what I'd like to mention, too, that HB 149 is also in the hopper that deals with the meth bills, and I think that may end up being the vehicle rather than this one, but we shall see. So, thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you. We do have some people online here. Sergeant Tim Burt?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I have you online. You're here. Very good. That's even better. Come on.
Do you want to go to the line first? Or?
No, the chair is fine.
Thank you, sir. Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Please state your name and your occupation.
Certainly. I'm Sergeant Timothy Burt with the Alaska State Troopers here on behalf of the Department of Public Safety in support of House Bill 99. Common trend that we've seen with meth labs here in the state of Alaska since about 1997 or 98 when they first showed up is that there's a common complete disregard by those who manufacture methamphetamine for their safety as well as the safety of others around them, to include children, neighbors, other persons living in the residence, law enforcement, or anyone else who may be in the vicinity or come across that area while they're there or after they leave. They assemble chemicals that have legitimate uses, and the manner in which they store these chemicals, bring them together, combine them, and the products which they manufacture utilizing these chemicals creates situations or scenarios that are extremely hazardous. The chemicals themselves may or may not have hazardous characteristics that they bring in by themselves, but then as they add additional different chemicals in proximity to others that are incompatible, the gases and items which are created, again, creates extremely hazardous situations to anyone who may be in the vicinity, whether these chemicals are, say, vented intentionally into an area where children are present, or unintentionally vented through the irresponsible acts of these methamphetamine cooks. The meth labs themselves, the chemicals are commonly found, say, from floor level up to countertop to tabletop level. This is also the region in which we commonly find children. Children spend most of their time living and growing in these areas, so it makes it an extremely hazardous situation for children as well. I'm available for any questions, and again, we're here in support of House Bill 99.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Representative Stoltz.
Thank you. Can you just maybe describe the compounds that go into methamphetamines over the counter and otherwise? Just what you typically find when you're...
Certainly, Mr. Chair, through the Chair, Representative Stoltz. Commonly here in Alaska, we've got two primary methods of manufacturing methamphetamine. One method utilizes lithium metal and hydrous ammonia and pseudoephedrine. Pseudoephedrine is a common chemical that also is utilized in the second method of manufacture, which utilizes iodine and red phosphorus. It's combining these catalyst reagents and precursors in proximity to other items such as drain cleaner, whether it be strong sulfuric acid or sodium hydroxide, very strong acids and bases, solvents such as acetone, heat, ether, these are primarily the chemicals that we're talking about.
Okay. I have a follow-up just on the amounts of the pseudoephedrine or I buy a lot of it for allergies. What's a typical quantity? Is it the amount you get at a convenience store during a purchase, or is it in the hundreds of units? I'm just trying to weed through this to benefit future consideration of other bills.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, through the Chair, Representative Stoltz, in the manufacturing process, obviously the more chemicals you put in the front, the more finished product methamphetamine you'll get out the back. But what we see is these smaller, what we refer to as box labs, small mom and pop labs, they can take a few boxes of pseudoephedrine, what you would commonly purchase at the convenience store over the counter, and manufacture either grams or up to ounces of methamphetamine. A simple rule of thumb would be for every one unit of pseudoephedrine that you put in the front, you'd get about 3/4 of a unit of methamphetamine out the back.
Anything else?
That's the. I only know about this anecdotally, when I visited the facility out in Wasilla and talked to Casanovas and I think obviously Sergeant Berg out there. I was asked that. I think they Costco sells some type of a generic with 96 units in a box, and I guess it's under DEA either mandate or recommendation or cooperation limited to one box. So I was trying to search what the magic number was, but I guess it depends on what the scale of the operation is.
Mr. Chair, through the Chair, Representative Stoltz. Yes, in my experience, the 96 count box is the preferred box that persons would purchase or obtain for manufacturing methamphetamine. I believe that's because that's the highest count box that's typically available over the counter. The other part of, I believe, your question, in regards to retailers who limit the number of boxes of pseudoephedrine products, my understanding at this point is it's more an issue of whether or not the business wants to be a good good citizen of the community and self-regulates the number of boxes. In regards to pseudoephedrine, I don't believe there's any federal regulation at this point that regulates the number of boxes or amount of product that can be purchased. And there's no state regulation at this point either.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We have some additional questions. Representative Schnell and Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tim, could you give us a rough count of how many MET labs have been busted in the state in the last year, 2 years, or 5 years?
Ooh. I know we have those numbers. I didn't bring them up to the table with me. Actually, Mr. Chair, through the chair. I know that in the Mat-Su Valley, it's probably 50 to 60 meth labs for last year, I believe. And again, that's just counting the Mat-Su Valley. That doesn't count the rest of the state.
50 or 60 in the last year?
For 04.
And the reason I'm asking this is I look at three fiscal notes, and all three of them are zero. That's from law, from the public defender, and also the troopers. Curious, is I haven't seen one from corrections yet, but I haven't seen it. I'm just curious if you or the troopers have been involved with 60 cases, 50 or 60, and that's only in the Mat-Su. Then I look at Anchorage, I look at Fairbanks. I know that there's problems on the Kenai. That I think the problem is a lot bigger than what we may be letting on. And I'm curious as to, not that I have a problem with the cost, but I'd like to know what the costs are up front, to the best of our knowledge, before we end up with a bigger problem as far as being able to finance it than what it looks like the bill actually is at this time. So I know it's a bigger problem, I think, than what these notes are showing, and so I'm curious of that. That's not something that we need to talk to you about, but we'll be talking about that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Mr. Birch, I was curious as to, you made a comment here a moment ago that the state has no restrictions on the number of units that can be purchased in ephedrine or pseudoephed. It crosses my mind that we might consider not allowing sale of any ephedrine at all. What are your thoughts?
Pseudoephedrine, it actually is has legitimate purposes. If it's sold over the counter through the cold tablets, I think it needs to be regulated, restricted for more than what it is now. Obviously, it's unrestricted at this point, but restricting it is certainly going to help out with the methamphetamine problem. I know other states that have restricted the sales and purchase of pseudoephedrine type products over the counter have experienced a dramatic decrease in the meth labs that they've had to seize, and that drop in their meth labs happened almost immediate to passage of their laws.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I might offer that I've had an interesting discussion with a pharmacist who said to me that he thought that if ephedrine came off the market completely, it wouldn't make any difference, that there's enough other options for people, that if, in fact, we might look at it from a state standpoint to look at and see if there isn't some reason that we could actually remove it from being sold in the state of Alaska at all. And if we so did, we would drastically reduce the number of meth labs in Alaska. So I guess my comment to you is, if people couldn't get ephedrine, if they couldn't get pseudoephed, do they have other options for making methamphetamine?
Mr. Chair, through the chair, Representative Holmes, there are other options for pseudoephedrine. Items, pseudoephedrine in a gel cap form or cough syrup is an extremely complicated process for them to obtain or harvest the pseudoephedrine for manufacturing purposes of methamphetamine. However, those items are still legitimate for over-the-counter use for cold tablets. Mm-hmm. The pseudoephedrine that has been regulated in other states, for instance, Oklahoma, they regulated the actual cold tablets, not the gel caps and not the cough syrup. It's the cold tablets themselves that the pseudoephedrine is easily harvested from, and with the intent of manufacturing methamphetamine.
So are you telling me that there would be a possibility that we could do that with the cold tablets and remove them from the shelves of Alaska to mitigate the meth lab proliferation? Through the chair.
Mr. Chair, through the chair. Yes, the controlling pseudoephedrine products such as the cold tablets would certainly have an impact on methamphetamine labs.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, I think that might well be something we should look at, so thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Holmes. Is there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I have James Steele, but I understand you're just online teleconference for questions. Is that correct, Mr. Steele?
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I could make a few comments.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. As noted, my name's James Steele. I'm the Children's Services Manager for the South Central Region of the Office of Children's Services. And I'm here also to speak in favor of and support for House Bill 99. I come in contact with the issues of meth and meth labs, not only in my role with the Office of Children's Services, but also in my role as Deputy Chief for the Central Mat-Su Fire Department here in Wasilla. And just a side note, we are now the second busiest fire department in the state of Alaska due to all of our growth. But not only does the Mat-Su area have the fastest growing distinction in population base in the state, but as the previous speaker noted, we also now have the dubious distinction of being the fastest growing, we have the fastest growing numbers of clandestine drug labs now, or drug lab seizures in the state of Alaska. In discussion with the local Mat-Su drug teams, 2 years ago, the local drug teams seized 30 labs here within the Mat-Su area. Last year, it was up to 51. So we also have seen labs within motels, within multiplexes. As the last speaker noted, one of the critical problems is that when people are cooking this product, cooking the meth within the buildings, the walls, the carpets, the surfaces become contaminated with the fumes, and during the cooks, the production methods can be extremely dangerous. Toxic fumes, corrosive chemicals, poisonous gases are produced, which pose extreme risk, both short-term and long-term, for those exposed. In the Office of Children's Services here last year, we took custody and 10 of the reports that we received related to meth. Out of those 10, we took custody in 8 active labs. We've had our workers who have had to transport kids locally to the hospital. The kids have had to be decontaminated because of their exposures. We've even had workers who have had to be decontaminated because of secondary exposure due to that primary exposure from the children that they simply transported. As the previous speaker noted, part of the issue with the children are that it's just normal behaviors that they're exhibiting, such as crawling or touching their surroundings. Oftentimes, we see toddlers placing their fingers into their mouths. It's a normal reaction. And they come into contact with those dangerous chemicals. So currently, we are receiving approximately 40 reports monthly here in the Mat-Su office that relate some aspect of meth or the production of meth. So it's a tremendously growing issue here for us. So I'm open for any questions that anyone has, but I do appreciate the time to make these comments.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Steele. We do have a question, Representative Stoltz.
Hi, Mr. Steele. This is Bill Stoltz. Thank you for, you're one of the spearheads of the Valley effort that's putting a lot of energy into this, bringing this issue forward. So it's been on a lot of our minds the years I've been in the legislature. That's why I wanted public safety. As a responder, how often are you guys, the first responder, discovering that there is a meth lab, given the volatility of that manufacturer, where the fireman is the first man on the scene before the other pop? Is that?
Representative Stoltz, it does occur. Oftentimes, we do not find out until later into the incident that the cause of the situation was as a result of a meth cook. We have responded in a situation where there was an explosion within one, and a lady was critically burned, and there was a 2-year-old child within 12 feet of her when this occurred. We've also responded to car fires where there were mobile labs within the vehicles themselves. So it does occur. I can't put a number on it for you.
Mr. Chairman, seeing the apparatus and the gear that the police officials use when they go into it, it looks like something like a toxic waste cleanup. I have a lot of empathy for emergency responders, so we're going to keep working with you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Steele, for your testimony and for being available for questions.
Thank you.
Was there anybody else who wanted to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on this. I think what we'll do, we're going to hold this bill. There does seem to be some other bills that have been introduced that are similar to this, and perhaps we can maybe merge all three bills in together. So if that's possible, then it doesn't seem to make too much sense to take amendments to this one at this particular time.
The marijuana bill, too?
It may be. So we'll hold off on the amendments, and we'll hold this bill, and we'll revisit this once we can take a look at the other bills that are out there.
I did have one question, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, go ahead,
Representative. And we probably can wait. I just wanted to note it in case I forget. It just couldn't possibly affect homebrew or wine or beer manufacture, I didn't think, but I'll ask that next time it comes out.
Okay.
Now that I said it out loud, I'm not remembering.
Very good, yes. We'll save that one. Okay, well, I think that's Chairman Chenault did not feel like we had enough time to take up supplemental, so I think that will conclude our business today. We are meeting tomorrow. We're going to have just an overview on the Emerita Hess Alaska Capital Corporation bill. That bill picked up an additional committee hearing this morning, a judiciary hearing, so it'll be a while before we'll actually be able to take any action on it. But there are several mayors lined up from various cities who are going to be testifying on the merits of the Emerita Hess. So we'll go ahead and take that testimony tomorrow. But we will not take any action on the bill. We'll should be able to finish the House Bill 35 tomorrow. And then Wednesday we have a couple more bills: contractor license enforcement, which is House Bill 81. Senate Bill 60, which is to extend the Suicide Prevention Council. And then on Thursday, looks like an overview, which Chairman Chenault has set up. And Friday, as of right now, we're not sure what will be taken up. So, Representative Chenault, did you have anything else you wanted to add before we conclude today?
No, not at this time.
Okay, anything the committee members like to bring up? No, we're adjourned until tomorrow.